and welcome back to Subspace Radio. It's still me, Kevin.
And it's still me, Rob.
How dare they start Star Trek in the middle of a comedy festival is all I have to say, Rob.
Look. Discovery had an uphill battle with me anyway, and it's not doing itself any favors. It's making it very hard for me to love it by putting it on during the busiest time of the independent theater, comedy, improv, cabaret, burlesque scene in Melbourne to chuck it on right smack bang in the middle of 4 weeks of fun and hell. And do you want to come see my show? Have you seen my show? What's going on? Oh, it's a tough festival. It's a quiet festival. It's a tough festival. It's a fun festival. Yes. Yep.
For any of our listeners who may be outside of Melbourne, the Melbourne Comedy Festival is on at the moment, which is always a busy time for Rob. And so all this week I've been like, have you watched it yet? Have you watched the Star Trek yet? And every time I asked, I felt like, you know, I am raising the bar for what this episode has to do to be a good time for Rob Lloyd and not a chore.
Look, if there was any way for me to enjoy watching Discovery, it is watching it knowing that I'll get to talk about it with you. Listeners... You are not going to have our usual sort of like...
It's not going to be unvarnished praise.
You're going to be dragging me along. You're going to be dragging me through this entire season, Kevin, of me like a petulant teenager going, are we there yet? Are we there yet?
Star Trek Prodigy Season 2 will be along soon enough to provide respite.
Very excited. Very excited to get back into Prodigy and travel with... Janeway, which is the real Janeway.
But we're here to talk about the two first episodes of season 5 of Star Trek Discoveries, episode 1, Red Directive, and episode 2, Under the Twin Moons. In Red Directive, there is a secret mission. They don't know why they're on the secret mission, but they must go on it. It's very red. There's a desert planet and a lot of scooter bikes that have been teased for, it feels like, more than a year. It feels like more than a year we saw the first trailer with the scooter bikes in the desert. So it was good to finally see where that was.
When the big trailer came out, they were pushing this scooter bike sequence. So it's been glad it's right at the top end of the season to go, here it is. This is what we've been promising you for over a year.
And at the end, two starships nose down into the planet's surface, and that is the thing we will be talking about in the second half of this episode, that moment of contact, first contact you might call it, of starships bumping into large objects.
I was going to say double contact, but there's a little bit of a a hint of sauciness connected to it, which, you know, would you expect any less from me, Kevin Yank?
So this episode, Red Directive, big picture, what'd you make of it?
Okay, so right off the bat, I think I've made it very clear. I am not the biggest Discovery fan. I tried in vain to go back and finish season 4 in preparation for this. I got 2 episodes in and I couldn't do it.
Did the recap at the start make any sense to you at all? Because I watched it and I was like, if I hadn't seen those episodes, I would not know what this was saying to me.
Look, I have no idea what the major threat was. I get a sense of stuff that's happening. We definitely hit season 5 and things are changing. The norm has changed. So we've got Tilly moving on to teaching. There's very few shows out there, television movies, that really capture the reality of teaching. Dangerous Minds with Michelle Pfeiffer does not do it. Boston Public does not do it. Abbott Elementary does a pretty good job of it. But to have Tilly as a teacher going, I really love teaching. I'm there going, oh, sweet summer child. That is one element to a very, very complex rainbow wheel of color shading.
Tell me how realistic the tipsy near miss in her quarters was. That I wonder how often that happens between tired teachers.
Oh, yeah. That hit home so hard. The reality of that was true. We've got Saru is now in a relationship and contemplating moving on. Book has moved on. So there's definitely a shift and a change within the norm of Discovery. So we hit the ground running. But there are still things that are, you know, situation normal. We still have the captain of our starship going on missions. Deadly dangerous missions right in the middle of it. I'm going, you've got crew to do that. Stay on your ship. Do your job as a captain. Come on, Michael.
I would buy that back when they were in the Kirk era, but they have gone so far into the future that you would expect one of the first things they told Captain Burnham upon arrival in the 29th century was, look, you can't do the missions anymore.
Can't do it.
We don't do that around here.
We have people to do that for you.
But it seems like it's not just her. We've got this Captain Rayner, who's also pretty gung-ho. So it seems the norm. Maybe it's come back around like fashion, Rob.
And look, everything comes back.
The Federation is so small now. They have so few people. They need the captains on the mission because who else is going to do it?
Exactly. Yeah, it's not them that are wrong. It's me that's wrong. That's very true, Kevin.
Yeah.
So yes, usual balance of domestic drama and issues of, you know, where the characters are at. All the characters in some way, shape or form will always doubt their place in the universe and where they are going. That's a big thing in Discovery, more so than any other show.
Do I deserve this? Am I in the right place?
Yeah. What is my place in this universe? It's a big thing, especially with Burnham. I mean, it's been her whole journey from, you know, traitor to captain. And that was the whole point of it, which we've talked about. You know, you've said many times, the whole point of the show was let's watch someone grow into becoming a captain. So that means we go through their trials and tribulations, their ups and downs. I did feel like I was coming in very much at the end of everything else. Seemed like I didn't miss much. It's just like, oh, this is where we are now. But the Michael and Book thing, I very much felt this sense of, okay, they've gone through some stuff because they were like inseparable for like two seasons.
The short version is they were even more inseparable. They were very much a couple in love. And then they had a very strong difference of opinion when Book's planet got destroyed. And
that's right.
Book wanted to resolve that through revenge if necessary, but whatever means necessary. And he stole a bomb from Starfleet and set it off. It didn't even work. So he took the risk and now he's paying the price. He was sentenced to community service, thankfully.
The impotence of toxic masculinity on show, even in the, you know, the 34th or whatever century.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was very intrigued because they dropped the main threat for this season, which relates directly back to an obscure Next Gen episode.
Oh, The Chase, season 6, episode 20 of The Next Generation. One of my favorite episodes of TNG, just because that big piece of world building it does of going, okay, this thing that has been admittedly conspicuous about Star Trek all this time, we are going to attempt to explain it by putting a big puzzle piece into place. And it was a one-off episode, and it was never used again until now. So I'm glad that it's back and that we're using it.
And especially so far in the future, so it's so separated from the canon that's been established from the 90s and recently, to just go, because it, from what it looks like, it's massive shape-changing. And normally that type of, you know, continuity changing stuff as well that we normally have happen near the end of an animated Star Trek series, and then it just turns out to be, you know, AI.
Yeah. So in the years where early years of Star Trek The Next Generation, when Star Trek was just becoming popular again, I remember that this conversation of, okay, but why are all of the aliens still humans in makeup? Can't we do better than that? Like, there was this sense in the Next Gen era that maybe we could be shooting for more. We're not in the 1960s anymore. The budgets are a little higher. Do we lack the imagination? And the fans at the time, as I remember it, the fans at the time made up this sort of lore of, like, this beta canon lore of the Preservers. Or the, actually, the Preservers is a name that was that Spock mentioned in a original series episode called The Paradise Syndrome in season 3. This is the one where there's an asteroid coming to destroy a planet where there happens to be Native American Indian tribes on it inexplicably.
Sure.
Captain Kirk loses his memory and becomes one of the tribes.
Oh, yeah, we've talked about that one.
Spock and McCoy need to work together in order to avert disaster.
Kirk gets married and has, like, his wife's pregnant, and then they both die. Yeah.
It's very sad. But at the end, they managed to reactivate this obelisk that diverts the asteroid.
Yes.
Spock says, "The obelisk is a marker, just as I thought. It was left by a super race known as the Preservers. They passed through the galaxy, rescuing primitive cultures, which were in danger of extinction, and seeding them, so to speak, where they could live and grow." And McCoy says, "I always wondered why there were so many humanoids scattered throughout the galaxy." And Spock said, "So have I. Apparently, the Preservers account for a number of them." And then when The Chase came out in Next Generation, Ronald D. Moore, who, you know, famous for his work on Deep Space Nine and Battlestar Galactica. And
then went on to do For All Mankind, which is amazing. I'd love to talk to you about that.
So he wrote or co-wrote this episode, The Chase, and he said he's considered but intentionally did not specify that the ancient humanoids seen in The Chase were in fact the Preservers. But there's always been this, you know, this flirtation with this idea that there was this great super race that is responsible for all these humanoids. Is there one called the Preservers? Are there two, the Preservers who did the Indians and the Progenitors now? Who
Progenitors, did the original
seeding? Yeah, this was something that fans were talking about even before the show was talking about it. And then now the show is kind of going, all right, we'll make it official. And it's really fun for that reason for me.
Yeah, and I think it's, look, it is a good way to have that as the arc for the entire final season of Discovery, which in many ways, you know, was the big bang restart, reboot of modern Star Trek within the last 15 years. It has to take credit for that, because everything that has come since is because of Discovery, you know, positive or negative, no matter where you stand.
Absolutely, yeah.
So to have its final season focus on something about the actual entire origins of...
I love it. They have managed to find a big question left unanswered in Star Trek, and they're spending a whole season on it. I couldn't be happier about that.
It's going to be, interesting to see whether it's explored deeply or they try and keep that, you know, the Indiana Jones style chase to find these...
That's right. These... And at the end they go, actually, we don't want the answers. We shouldn't know.
We shouldn't know, yes. Why does what does God want with a starship? Or what do the progenitors want with a human-looking alien?
Well, that's interesting to me as well. Like, all the times that Star Trek has I would say, ill-advisedly gone, let's go in search of God or the devil or, you know, this religious explanation for the meaning.
Which was a very Roddenberry thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was so odd. I guess late in life, that is what he was interested in. And I thought it never worked it never played to Star Trek's strengths. But this stuff is kind of, I think, exploring the same sort of theme, but in a science, capital S science fiction way. Like, what if all of the things that we often attribute to religion actually had a scientific explanation? And what would that mean to our sense of self and our sense of the galaxy? That is Star Trek for me.
Look, and it's a double-edged sword, and it's a thin line you have to walk. It has been explored in many different, I mean, everything old is new again when it comes to sci-fi, but, you know, stuff like Doctor Who explored that quite a bit, because back in the 70s, there was a lot of theories about, like, the Chariots of the God type thing, where, you know, ancient Earth civilization was actually inspired by aliens visiting thousands of years ago and giving them knowledge. That's like whole part of it. That was explored in a couple of Doctor Who stories back in the day.
That's ultimately what Stargate's about as well, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And even with the dangers of it, it's stuff like Prometheus, where they take this B-grade concept from Aliens and Alien and try, when Ridley Scott comes back and goes, I want to make my own version of 2001. But with, you know, B grade, you know, alien monsters. And so brings in, you know, all the space jockeys and turning them into these creatures that go from civilization to civilization, giving them knowledge or taking it away. It can either work or fail depending on how it's well thought out. So it's a thin line that Discovery is working on, but
it's going to depend. Is there a there? Like, do they ultimately have something to say with this platform? I guess is what we're looking for.
And that's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, they have to say something other than what Michael Burnham feels. And that's going to be very interesting to see how they do that.
The Chase had a, the original episode in Next Gen, The Chase had a funny ending that, like, it was, first of all, it was like a multi-race, like right now in Discovery, we've got the Starfleet racing against these two kind of renegades, and we don't really know their story yet. But
yeah, that's, the two thieves.
That's the race. In The Chase, it was Starfleet versus the Klingons versus the Cardassians versus the Romulans. All four of these groups were independently chasing down clues, and they ultimately could only find the solution by putting their knowledge together. And then the Romulans walked in at the last minute and said, "We've been shadowing you all under cloak." And standing in the back row was this extra who now is a whole character in Discovery.
I hope that actor gets some sort of
recognition. I hope so too. They recast him for the older version of him in holographic form, but it's a pretty good match. And the funny thing is, you go back and look on Memory Alpha, and the role, which has been retitled Vilik, because he wasn't even named in the original episode.
He was just Romulan in the background.
Yeah, so now it's named Vilik, but it still says unknown performer. So, at least as far as fandom is concerned, we have no idea who played that part.
In the original.
It's entirely possible that the producers of Star Trek don't know who played that part. It may be lost to history.
Well,
that would be hilarious,
man,
that they're using their likeness and putting a box around him on a view screen and going, "I hope this guy doesn't, come around and sue us."
Or maybe that's why they... Because there were a couple of others around there. Why did they specifically pick the one that they have not? Yeah.
One would hope they've figured out who he is and done a deal with him.
Well, they've done pretty well with hunting down former character actors who had bit parts and have even moved on from acting to come back to do voices of their character who was killed off in the original Lower Deck one.
It was a non-speaking role, so it literally would have been a day player who was just put up in makeup. And do they keep track of those names? I don't know.
Yeah, maybe in old school hard copy paper trail, they have to have a name of the ex, because that's the thing, you get paid, you don't get as paid as much if you're not talking. As soon as you say any line, you have to get paid more. So that would have been the lowest of low, schmo working actor being thrown on in makeup. I mean, it's a hell of a job to get paid a little bit of money, make to look like an alien and stand around on a set for a day in the 90s.
Yeah, and then 30 years later.
So what? Hopefully it wasn't Crispin Glover, because we don't want to go through that issues again from Back to the Future 2.
All right, I've got a few highlights. Let's rapid fire through these. So first I noted this is the first episode of Discovery where the Star Trek splash screen of the ship flying around the nebula at the start and making the delta happens. That's how long it's been since we've had a new episode of Discovery. They've started doing that since season 4 of Discovery. So seeing the ship spore jump in and then take off was actually delightful.
And it was Discovery, because I've mostly been seeing it in Strange New Worlds, where it's the Enterprise.
It's in all the other ones as well. Lower Decks does it in animated form with the koala hidden in the nebula. But they're all doing it. this episode opens with a warp scene from the outside. So it's kind of like a push in on space, and there's a bit of twinkling, and then we go into the twinkling and we see a ship in a warp bubble, and then we go into the warp bubble and it's Burnham standing on the back of the ship. And that, having just watched it recently, that effect of warp scene from the outside is almost exactly what is established in Star Trek Beyond, the last feature film of Star Trek that we got.
Yeah.
We see in the opening moments of that film as well, we see the Enterprise warping from the outside of the warp bubble, and it looks exactly like that. So I enjoyed the consistency.
Excellent. I'm going to say I'm a huge fan of, for me, the highlight was David Cronenberg back as our mysterious architect in the background. I mean, he's not an incredible actor, but he just, the gravity that he has as this old Canadian filmmaker pushing the boundaries of body horror is just absolutely having a ball going, "I'm in Star Trek. I'm friggin' loving it."
I like it every time. They have centered him in this year's the plot, so we're going to see a lot of him, I suspect, which is
definitely
delightful. Yes,
very welcome.
Red Directive, what do you think of this concept of a red directive? Because I both love and hate that it is never fully explained. They never stop and say, a red directive is dot, 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 dot. It's just a bunch of people going, this is a red directive, so stop arguing with me. And they all go, yeah. Oh, it's a red directive. Okay.
To use it in the title and be so vague about it kind of shat me up the wall. But this is the type of thing that happens with me and Discovery all the friggin' time. So if you're going to bring in a new directive thing, say what the friggin' hell it is. Come on, don't just, I know you all seem important and seem, you know, see the gravity of it. We can't see the gravity of it because we don't know what it is.
I have to say, it feels like Section 31 all over again to me.
Yeah.
It's this shadowy side of like, okay, Starfleet is telling people what to do and saying you're not allowed to know why. It's the covert ops of Starfleet. And initially we are asked to accept that it's for the greater good, but inevitably when they introduce something like this, the only interesting place to take it is absolute power corrupts absolutely, and we end up at war with Section 31's fleet of robot ships, and I don't know if I want to go down that road again. So I hope the Red Directive is used sparingly and briefly and never heard from again, personally.
Yeah. It's that case of bringing in Section 31 always is at odds in some ways with that, you know, shining vision of the future. That, and it's always finding that balance of, do you need a little bit of that darkness to keep the light of Federation, but how much manipulation does this underworldly? It's very much like a Dark Knight type of situation where there's so much machinations underneath that everything's far too clever for its own good.
Yeah.
So finding that balance is going to be interesting.
In the next episode, I think Captain Rayner says, I've been on 7 red directives already. And I'm just like, whoa, okay. That's too many red directives. I don't care what it is. That's too many.
It takes away the importance of it. You go, well, I've done 7. Well, I've done 20. All right, just, let's stop comparing red directives, okay?
Yeah. We meet our antagonists, let's say, in the season, Maul and Locke. And Locke's head is initially transparent when he takes off his helmet on the Romulan ship, which is cool. I don't know if there's going to be a story there, but they seem to be making a point of reminding us that we don't know what species Locke is.
Yeah, because he's a little bit first season Discovery Klingon looking. It'll be interesting to see if they are the, because they don't seem to be like the main threat. They're just like, they seem to be sort of like just, you know, soldiers of fortune, but not really helping anybody out and just moving from place to place doing this thing. And they've just seemed to have stumbled across this major universal important thing. There doesn't seem to be any sort of like overarching purpose for what they're doing. And even if they did, it seems a little bit out of character for these two who just seem to be, you know, scraping along the best they can within this future.
The whole sequence on the desert planet looked very expensive to me. And I noted that they put this episode on YouTube for free, at least in the United States. So there seems to have been this strategy of we're going to attempt to attract some new audience with this episode and spend a lot of money to do it. The fact that they were teasing these desert speeder bikes a year ago speaks to that for me as well, that like this is a set piece episode in the season. I'm expecting we won't see Discovery looking this expensive until maybe the season finale.
They've pretty much used up all their money now and spread it out sparingly so they can use it again for the final episodes.
There were like 5-10 minute sequences where I was watching it going, this is all amazing and beautiful, and I'm pretty sure I haven't seen a flesh and blood actor in 5 minutes.
That's
all CG.
Exactly. Definitely bringing that cinematic feel to the small screen to really just make people go, as opposed to what we like about Star Trek, we go, when there's people sitting around talking about policy.
We had Fred the synth asking how we can make an excellent deal today, Maul and Locke, after commenting on the sounds of their names.
Elements of Data, obviously, but also a little bit of Vorta.
Play a Vorta, couldn't he?
Yeah, a little bit of a sinister Vorta. Had an element of
slimy android.
Yeah, not full Jeffrey Combs. and not fully batshit crazy Iggy Pop, but but definitely an element of water there.
I should ask, as a Deep Space Nine fan, did you recognize that ancient humanoid progenitor in the still shot from Next Generation? Because the actress who plays it is also, she came back to play the founder, the head of the founders.
I was having a good look when it came up. And I went, oh, that's an interesting looking creature. I haven't seen the chase, obviously. And then I went, ooh, is that, this? She looks a little
bit
founder.
It's the exact same voice. It's definitely her, yeah. Before she was the founder, she was the ancient humanoid from the chase.
Who would have thought Star Trek likes to bring actors back to play different roles?
The split screen moment in on the speeder bikes where they're bickering back and forth and then the screen splits made me sit back in my seat and kind of go, I don't hate it. I don't love it. My partner, Jess, kind of went, nah, they lost me. That is too silly. And to me, it just added to this feeling that I think is the biggest challenge for Discovery is that the technology needs to be so advanced that so much stuff feels magical. And there's this feeling that there are no rules and anything could happen and so nothing matters. And when the split screens came in, I kind of went, this is almost, it's like a meta version of that, is that this show has no format. So no. When it breaks the format, you're almost like, is it breaking the format? Or is the fact that there is no format, there is no consistent style, is that what Discovery is? Is it? It's a playground for whatever idea they have that week.
Pretty much. And I think that's what's been its challenge in really connecting with, and that's what's made it easy for people who aren't real big Star Trek fans to connect to it. Yeah. Because they don't have that lore. Us ingrained in it for so long, they're going, but you're not following any of the things that's been established, and it's not charming. It's infuriating. And like you said, it is that case of, it feels like Harry Potter, that just everything appears when they need it.
A beautiful analogy. Yes, absolutely. Everything works when you need it. When Burnham falls through the hole in the ship and is immediately enveloped by an instant spacesuit that has a jetpack that can take her over to the cloaked ship that she can land on, I was just like, I am enjoying this. Like, it is entertaining and a little funny. Like, and it's played well when she gets hit by the space debris and goes, oh, that didn't feel good. Like, I did laugh, but Star Trek has always had rules, and I don't know if I'm just a grumpy old Star Trek fan or if there needs to be rules for the rule breaking to matter.
Yeah, I mean, it has taken away a little bit. I mean, with weekly sci-fi, the red shirt problem was always a major issue because we go, well, those guys are going to die because we're not losing Spock or Kirk. But it was that case of, because of this technology, they're invincible. So being hit by space debris and just doing like a John McClane line from Die Hard of, oh, that's going to hurt. And also like the moment of the threat of, we're in war. We've got this tractor beam. Burnham's on the back of it. You've got to get out of it. Oh, I'm flying away. And then she just flies into the bridge of Discovery, is warped in and just walks straight ahead. I'm going, you're trying to
make
it look
cool.
She's out
of breath, Rob. She's out of breath.
Is she, though? I think she's out of one breath, and then she gets straight back into it. And that, for me, I just went, I'm like throwing my plate up in the air. I'm throwing my water at the screen going, this is ridiculous. You just want it to look cool, and you've taken away any threat, any type of danger at all, because this person is a god and can do no wrong.
Then there's the avalanche and the ship's nose down in the desert, which, like everything else in this episode, looked really cool, was entertaining. I don't know. In research for this episode, I have watched a lot of other Starship crashes, and they were much more violent than this one. There is that brace, brace, brace moment, and the ship hits the ground, and everyone kind of just shifts in their seat.
Yeah.
They don't even shake the camera particularly hard. And I thought to myself, if this isn't dangerous, if flying a starship into the desert is not dangerous, what is dangerous in this world at this point?
It did end up on a jaunty 45-degree angle and move slightly up and down.
Yeah.
It looked cool, but there's so much, especially, I mean,
at least fall out of your chair. There were people standing who, you know, they didn't, like, they shifted, but they didn't really stumble.
It's more of a movie thing, because they've got, we've got the money now, let's do a crash, yeah, as opposed to back in the 60s or even the 90s where they went, well, the 60s, they went, well, we can't have the ship land every day, we don't have the money, let's create beaming. And in the 90s, they're going, we've still got to save our money, so let's use the same stock footage of ships flying. It's definitely a movie thing. But in all crashes previously, there's fatalities. No matter what happens, whether you're injured or some people are hurt, but people die every time the crash happens in Star Trek. That's the threat. You lose, sure, there are unknowns in the background, but you lose one or two people. They break a leg or hurt themselves, but one or two people die. This one, they didn't even get kicked out of their seat.
Yeah, but I don't know. Bombastic opening to the season. I like what they're doing with the plot. That problem of nothing matters has been true for more than a season now, so it's not new. But I sure wish they would have made more of a starship crashing into the desert. So we'll talk about that. The one thing they did do with it, though, is when the ship warped back or jumped back to Starfleet headquarters, there was sand floating off of its hull into space, and I loved the look of that. At first, I thought it was just kind of like steam, and I thought it was something new they were doing with the spore jump effect, and I thought that looked really cool. I regret that there isn't, you know, spores floating off the surface of the ship every time it jumps now, because it looked awesome. But anyway, that is Red Directive. Let's briefly talk about Under the Twin Moons before we share our other examples of starship crashes.
Yeah, this one was more of a two-hander. So it was definitely focusing on Saru's final mission before he becomes ambassador and goes off to get married, as some cultures would call it. And so, like, yeah, Saru and Burnham again. Oh, who would have thought? But Burnham and Saru going on this vital mission to find out a bit more about where the possible location of this planet, where the thing is with the thing with the thing.
I really enjoyed the two-hander with Saru and Burnham. I mean, you gave me my second chance, and what am I going to do without a first officer like you stuff? It is laid on a bit thick, but it is mostly earned for me, having watched the four seasons up until now. And just the fun of the romp through the forest and action Saru and all that sort of stuff was fun. I really enjoyed Burnham wrestling with the decisions she was making on the planet. Like, she wanted to sacrifice herself to the drones rather than sending Saru, but ultimately she made the hard choice, and seeing her grit her teeth and go, oh, I might regret this, and then it turning out to be the right decision. Like, all of that stuff, along with the science team on the ship, like, working in real time with them to unravel the puzzle of the electromagnetic field. All of that felt like A-grade Star Trek to me, and I really enjoyed it.
Action with science is always a good balance with Star Trek.
Yeah.
We've got the people doing the action-y stuff, and they need the scientists to work at double speed, triple speed, to sort out this problem. So it's science and action hand in hand. Always works well.
We're losing our foot here. Oh my God, who lost their foot? No, no.
It's a turn of phrase. It's always great seeing Doug Jones flex his action muscles. But yeah, it is that case of, there's always that element for me of Star Trek of, I love the regimented, formal nature of everything. And so when emotions are conveyed, for me, it hits more powerfully because it's seeping through.
Right, it needs to be cracking through the surface unintentionally rather than, oh, here's the part of the day where I'm going to profess my feelings to my coworkers again.
So, it's so much more powerful at the end of Star Trek II when it's even like with the death of Spock and the trauma of seeing him die in, you know, radiation. But that moment where his voice cracks on human, that's where you lose your shit because you could see... You can see how much this has affected Kirk, but he keeps it in. Whereas Burnham cries at the drop of a hat. I know that drama has evolved, but they were able to keep that up even with Next Gen, some of those connections with the community that was created within the Next Gen cast and the emotions they displayed in that capacity was incredible. But Burnham is very much a case of, I'm so frustrated. I'm so angry. What am I going to do without you? It's very laid on thick, and it's very hard for me to connect with.
I'll agree that it's still there in a way that I wish that it wasn't, but I think they have toned it down a step, at least in this episode, in a way that I appreciate. And that moment behind the rock when you see Burnham send her first officer potentially to his death, and she is expressing emotion not to someone but to herself, and it is seeping out of her professional demeanor. That is the moment I've been craving more of in Discovery.
Yeah, it's a masterclass as well from Doug Jones, and that's why he is the best at what he does, because he plays that element of Spock, Data, element of not being as emotional as the human, but because of that, that affords him this beautiful range and nuance to how he expresses his emotion, plus under layers and layers of makeup. He is just a superstar of conveying emotion through
not
character
just makeup,
work.
But those boots as well. Man, oh, I am loving how much full body Saru we're getting this season as well, because he looks twice as alien when you see his feet and legs as well.
How can he run in those things? I'm going, Bryce Dallas Howard, how can you beat a T-Rex in heels in Jurassic World? her and Doug Jones should get together and have a 100-meter dash and see who wins. Oh my God.
That's right. The Ready Room after show for this episode talks about the running in the forest stuff. And Doug Jones gives credit to his stunt guy, who is shown in a behind the scenes clip. They put a conveyor belt on the floor of the forest to enable the person to run faster. So it's a stunt guy in the tall boots running on a conveyor belt in the forest past the camera, and it looks great, but wow,
yeah,
it's quite a physical feat.
Yeah, those sequences I really liked. I'm watching it there going, this is, you know, I'm not saying it with chagrin. I'm not saying it, you know, biting my lip going, all right. I'm there going, no, this is good Star Trek. This is, you know, sure, they just put their hand out and they, you know, accio their guns. Mm. I'm going, oh, for heaven's sake, that's just fancy for no reason. You have a holster. I don't care if you're 3 million years in the future. You could have your gun in a holster. It's all right. Oh my gosh! Stop showing off.
Save some energy.
Hey, this goes, it has to
turn
go
out
somewhere.
The lights when you leave the room.
I love the. I was a bit excited, but you realize the money wasn't there. The big statues and like the huge hand coming out of the foresty jungle was really fascinating, and the head creeping out of the earth was great. And I was hoping, like, when they looked at it, they went, "Oh no!" And the eye kind of opened. I went, "Is that head gonna move?"
Yeah.
I was really excited, going, "That would be. Oh, okay. No, there's just creatures inside it that just look like probes." Yeah. And but yeah, I had that element of yeah. Yeah, come on. I don't want to just see bikes 1 week. I want to see huge rock-like creatures come out. Oh, okay, no. We've just got the probes.
Yeah. We had the desert last week when we had the forest this week. Are we going to have the ice planet next week? And then lava planet the week after?
Follow the George Lucas color plate of planets. So, have sand and green, and let's have either ice or lava.
Well, we're going to Trill, so we know we're having the caverns with the blue liquid next week.
We will have the caverns and the blue liquid. Love a good bit of Trill action. But Saru using his darts to knock out all the probes was a little bit cartoon 80s series for me.
I appreciate the payoff. Like, they made a big deal of Saru getting those darts 2 seasons ago.
Yeah.
And it hasn't really amounted to much. So I'm glad they used it before they send off the character onto his next mission.
Now, do we know that Doug is out, or is he still in it, just not on the ship every week?
It is unclear. Certainly his interview on the Ready Room was a farewell interview, but Will Wheaton was very careful to say, this is your last week on the USS Discovery as first officer.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be a Tilly situation where they come and go as their availability dictates.
Of course.
Yeah. This is a feeling I get from modern Star Trek in general, and it's the difference from the 1980s and 90s when we had 24-episode seasons and these actors were locked into contracts. And if you're making 24 episodes a year, you don't have time to do much else. That is your full-time job.
Yeah.
here in the 2020s, we're doing 10 episodes. It's being shot in 2 or 3 months. And the rest of the year is your time. And you are using your platform on Star Trek as an actor to get other gigs. And you're becoming more and more famous, more and more expensive, more and more difficult to schedule. And so I am, as a viewer, I can't escape the feeling as these characters sometimes are not present, sometimes are mentioned off screen, that this is kind of a side gig for everyone. I just don't feel the commitment and dedication professionally that we used to get from our Star Trek. I don't know if I have a legitimate grievance there as an audience member, but yeah, I want Tig Notaro every single week. She's either on the show or she's not.
Of course.
And the fact that half the cast are guest stars kind of bothers me in a way. And this isn't just a Discovery thing. It's even happening in Strange New Worlds.
Look, well, it is. I mean, for me, Discovery has always been, it hasn't been an ensemble. It's been Michael Burnham. It's been the Michael Burnham show, and everyone else is a supporting character. But it is, you brought up a very important issue, and it's definitely come into light last year with, I'm sorry to get a bit serious from the outside world, but the writer's strike and the actor's strike showed that the way that we consume our entertainment has changed so much over the decades, and especially at the moment, we're in a form of consuming entertainment that we haven't fully understood or set up regulations for. So it's kind of been dictated by studios and these faceless, rich, white guys who are doing it for money and profit as opposed to artistic endeavor. So finding that balance has always been tough ever since, you know, theater was created or acting was created. But it has become a case of, we're not looking at actors who are making big bucks, millions of dollars. These are jobbing actors.
And yeah, I certainly don't blame the actors for taking other jobs and pursuing their career and doing what they need to pay the bills.
Yeah.
It is unfortunate. I guess if I'm complaining about anything, it is the system that you describe that, that prevents actors from making the living they deserve when they are on the biggest Star Trek show going.
Yeah, I mean, to get your equity card, you need to have worked so many jobs, and to earn enough money just to have health care as an actor, you need to earn a certain amount of money every year. And most actors, the 95% of actors who are working in America at the moment, don't have enough money for a sustainable career. And that's horrifying. Even someone like Doug Jones, who is an established performer, a trailblazer when it comes to physical, you know, practical performance. They've got these aren't superstars. These aren't Leonardo DiCaprio's or stuff like that. These are actors working from job to job. And if their schedules have been dropped from 24 episodes a year to just 10, they've got so much free time and they can't just stick around and wait. They, like you said, they've got to earn their money. They've got to pay their rent. They've got to be able to, you know, if they get sick, they need to be able to pay to get healed.
In some ways, they're like, this is the cost of things getting better. Like, I mean, we had Anson Mount somewhat absent from season 2 of Strange New Worlds because his wife was having a baby and he was
having
a father.
Bubby.
And you read back to the original series and the movies and Next Generation era, and people could not take time away to be with their family when they were having kids, and marriages collapsed because of it. The number of divorces created by Star Trek is probably into the three figures by now. And the fact that in today's modern way of making prestige television, people can and do take time away. I mean, I can't argue against that. As a selfish audience member, it makes a difference. There is a cost.
And it does. It does make it harder to make, when you see characters 24 episodes a season for 7 seasons, whether they're, whether they're incredible episodes or dud episodes, whether they're just in the background or whether they're a crucial character in it, they are there just from being for there for so long in your face. They become connected, interwoven with your heart. But cutting it down from 24 to 10 at the most, when those characters leave and move, it's harder to have that emotional connection. Even like in season 1 of Strange New Worlds, where we had a character loss. It was heartbreaking, yeah. But you're there going, well, this character was wonderful and lovely, and I'm glad that he's been coming back in other roles over season two. But you're there going, it's powerful, but it's not really hitting hard because they've only been around for 6-7 episodes. Yeah.
Discovery's going to end, and it's going to have made 50 episodes of television, and that is barely more than two seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation. Star Trek The Next Generation was only just getting good by the end of season two, so it's no wonder these shows.
And that's the thing, like the big rule back in the day was you had to hit 100 episodes for syndication, was that
that's
it?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so that was episode TV shows, especially genre shows, always going, we got to hit that 100. Because that's where residuals, that's where, the real money comes in, because that's the money that will keep on coming through advertising, through cable, through all that type of stuff, where the show will just keep on running. And that's how actors like Sarah Michelle Gellar can keep on working, but they get a large chunk of their money from residuals. And that's a big issue with streaming at the moment. There's no transparency about how many people are watching, how much money the streamers are making, and so therefore how much money is deserved to the actors and producers and the production crew.
So back to Under the Twin Moons, apart from the jaunt on the planet, the other big, like, there were two other elements to this episode. There was Rayner's trial, his early retirement, and his appointment as first officer of Discovery next week. I'm looking forward to that, how that's going to go. I think that will be an interesting and entertaining change from Jones's Saru.
I like Rayner. He's a pain in the ass, but that's what the show needs. It needs someone who doesn't just adore Burnham.
Some non-sentimentality, please.
Please? Can we please? there's a show in the 80s called V. I don't know if you ever watched V. I loved V.
I've never watched it, no.
Yeah. So it's about lizard aliens who come to Earth disguised as humans and try and, say they're bringing all this technology, but in the end, they're just trying to harvest us all and take us back for food. It was very much an analogy of World War II. It came out in the early 80s. Anyway, all the characters were very clean cut, all white, white hat brigade type of heroes, and they did like telemovies, and about halfway through the second telemovie, they introduced a character called Ham Tyler, played by the great Michael Ironside. I don't know if Michael Ironside's ever done a Star Trek. He's definitely, done his fair share of genre work with.
So he'd Total fit Re- right in is what you're saying.
Yeah. But he came in as like a Rayner character. Ham Tyler came into V and he was a mercenary. He was, he did all the underhanded nasty stuff that all the other pure white hat characters wouldn't do. And that was what the show needed. It needed a character to come in who gets down in the dirt, gets gritty, who, is a little bit of an anti-hero, which we use as a phrase nowadays. But this is what I see in Rayner. Rayner's that character who isn't involved in the sycophantic, oh, I love you. No, I love you. No, I love you. I love you. He's there going, this is bullshit. No, I'm not going to do what you say.
Can we go? Can we stop talking about our feelings and walk forward, please? He did that twice in the first episode, and it was great.
Yeah, and like we didn't even see him for these first sequence. He's just a voice. A voice in with a tractor beam ship. And the trial scene was amazing. I just love it. He's just there going, this is crap. I don't like any of this. And swearing, I'm going, okay, I'm not a big fan of swearing in Star Trek, but I'm going, this is
kind of could have
cool.
done without it, but still, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like just there going, we all think this at some point. Even during the beautiful episode of Strange New World Season 2 with the trial, we just screaming at Rebecca Romijn going, just say this is all crap. Just stand up and walk out. You don't deserve to be put on trial. But he said it. He's there going,
this is politics.
It's all politics. And going, great, love it. Yeah. And he's the perfect balance for Burnham. Burnham doesn't need someone just telling her how wonderful she is. Needs someone
Burnham
who challenges.
Burnham is too sentimental for her own good. And Rayner is not sentimental enough for his own good. And it's a great balance.
He's the pragmatist. She's the sentimentalist. Sentimentalist? Mm. Sentimentalist. Yeah. So I'm very interested to see where that goes. And some interesting stuff going on with Book. They're trying to make it seem that we
Mall
need to...
is Book's mentor's daughter, which I just wrote Small Galaxy. This is the Small Galaxy problem we get in Star Trek. Everyone is related to everyone.
With you saying that, saying it back to me now, yeah. I make sense of it. But for me, all I can hear when you say that is your Rick Moranis in Spaceballs going, I was your former brothers, sisters, nephews, cousins, former roommate.
Book took the name of his mentor. There has been a long line of couriers named Cleveland Booker. And there's always a Cleveland Booker in the neighborhood. So the Book that we know just took on that mantle from his mentor. But what we learned this week is that Maul was the daughter of the previous Cleveland Booker.
Yeah, they tried to put in all this effort. Goes, this is the daughter of a guy I knew.
I never met her.
Yeah, I went, ooh, this is important.
Yeah, I gotta say, it's one thing to go, look, for plot reasons, these two people have to have met, even though it's a great big galaxy. But at least from what we've seen this week, it doesn't actually mean much. So why bend over backwards to make that happen? Oh, well, I guess we'll see next week.
Look, and continue on with the magic going, okay, here's a photo of or an image of this particular character. Okay, de-age it.
Yep.
You know, what, 12 years? And the hair color changes? Up there going, get the hell out of here.
The computer knows that she did a bleach job.
Oh my God. It's just like, yeah, it's like in Blade Runner where they have a really dodgy, grainy photo and all the Harrison Ford has to do is say, enhance. Uh-huh. Oh, okay. And that clears up the photo as well. Get the hell out of here. You're using science fiction as magic. It's
getting
nonsense.
More true every day with these AI models, Rob. Oof.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. Okay. Sorry, my AI is glitching. I'm not really here. I'm still in bed.
Oh.
This is the AI avatar of me.
Let's talk about crashing starships.
Yes. Yes. Let's talk about crashing starships.
You go first. What comes to mind?
Okay. Well, I won't go with the obvious one. Are we going timeline or are you just going wibbly wobbly?
Nah. Let's just go wibbly wobbly. We're finding our feet again.
Well, I kind of am going from original series. I'm jumping into the movies and I'm jumping into the Kelvin timeline. I'm going into the film that dare not speak its name because it's a piece of ass, but I will talk about Into Darkness.
Yes.
It's got the big, because it does what all the Michael Bay movies did. Are we going to have a big crash just out in the middle of nowhere? No, it's more exciting if it happens in a city.
In a city. I am glad you want to talk about this one because, I have such mixed feelings about this one. I went back and rewatched it. It is an impressive piece of CG.
It looks amazing.
It looks amazing. The chase through San Francisco looks amazing.
Yep.
But I never think back to this fondly because the movie has already lost me by this point in so many ways.
Completely. In some ways. Oh, yeah. Hey, sorry, I'm projecting. Yeah.
But on its own, this is an incredible sequence. The thing that I remember the most about it is before I saw this movie, I saw the posters for this movie and I saw the trailers for this movie.
Yes.
And the posters had the silhouette of a Starfleet ship with a saucer and two nacelles kind of nosing down.
Yes.
And I think one even had it plowing through San Francisco Bay with kicking up the water in front of it. So it was, again, a silhouette backlit.
That image was shared around a lot.
Yeah, and certainly the final trailer, it has a brief clip of something moving through the skyscrapers of San Francisco for half a second. And then later in the trailer, it has the iconic saucer plowing through the water, kicking it up with the backlight. And in all of the marketing for this movie, we are led to believe that is the Enterprise crashing. There are lines from Scotty that says, the ship, it's dead. We're going down. All of the clips in the marketing lead us to believe this is going to be an Enterprise crash. And so we as audience all showed up expecting, bracing ourselves for the Enterprise crash sequence. And this is a J.J. Abrams bit of sleight of hand where he played a trick on us. And in the same way that they did not admit until the movie was out that Benedict Cumberbatch was playing Khan.
No, he's John
Harriman.
John Harrow. That's right.
Yeah.
Gee. No, no, he's not Khan. He's not Khan at all. Sure, it's on IMDb, but no, no, no. He's this new character that you've never heard of before, but we're going to invest in.
But yeah, this personally, and I can't really explain it, but it bothered me more than the Khan thing, was in the movie, Enterprise, it loses all power. It's plummeting towards the Earth. You're like, here it goes. Here we go. We're going to have the crash.
Thing from the footage.
And then at the last minute, Kirk sacrifices himself, reconnects the engine, and the ship like lifts up above the cloud layer, and all is saved. And then the big bad ship, the Vengeance, I think it's
Vengeance,
called.
Vengeance, yeah.
Swooshes past and under, because it's had all of the torpedoes exploded in it, it crashes, and Khan deliberately directs it towards San Francisco as his last act of revenge. And I was, wow, this is all impressive. But sitting in the cinema, I was sitting there going, huh, they tricked us. The Enterprise isn't going to crash. I was all ready to mourn my friend, the Enterprise, once again. Yep. And nope, it's a bait and switch. And now I can't bring myself to care.
And then they just went, just wait until the next movie. We'll blow up the Enterprise again.
I dare say this crash has the most implied carnage associated with it. Like,
yes.
This is the most deadly crash we've seen in Star Trek. And not a lot of is made of it. It's like, at the end, it's like, wow, we managed to bring Kirk back to life. Weren't we lucky? And no mention made of the doubtless thousands of people killed in the San Francisco incident.
You have knocked down so many towers. Oh my God. Yeah. There are so many people. There are people in that.
Yeah.
It's like the Superman movie with Henry Cavill, Man of Steel. Everyone got so angry because there's so much carnage and so many people die. Because the big thing about Superman is he tries to save people while fighting a big bad. And he just doesn't do that in this one. It's just the case of same thing. You're going, wow, look at that. Kirk's alive. Isn't that amazing? No collateral damage at all.
Yeah. Just to correct myself for any listeners screaming, it was John Harrison in this
Harrison, movie. Not Harrington.
Harriman must have been some admiral that I'm thinking of somewhere along the way.
Look, if anything, it would have been more shocking if his big reveal at the end of being trapped in there, when he said, I am Khan. Nobody knew who Khan was in the movie. He said, I am John Harrison. And they go, oh my God, not you. That would have been made more sense because it would have made sense in the reality of that. Anyway, it's to quote Benoit Blanc in The Glass Onion, it's just dumb. It's just dumb. Sorry.
It is spectacular. And the sequence on the Enterprise before it doesn't crash is also spectacular. Like they lose artificial gravity and the ship is spinning in the air and people are having to run along the walls and jump over great chasms in the ship that exist for some reason. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun, but this ship this movie is quite mindless. And in the end, I can't let myself care about it because it is so shocking what happens in San Francisco at the end and is not dealt with or reckoned with in any way that I have to just kind of let this movie blow over me and not matter.
Look, Chris Pine survived, all right? So just get some perspective, could you, Kevin? Okay, how about you? What's your big crash?
I'm going to take us to almost the opposite in a way. This is an episode of Star Trek Voyager, Season 5, Episode 6, called Timeless. And the entire episode is about trying to avoid a starship crash. It opens on an icy planet and two people in snowsuits who turn out to be older Harry Kim and older Chakotay. They beam
down.
That's
right, yes.
And they are on the surface of a glacier and the camera zooms out and you see the Voyager is trapped underneath the ice.
I do remember that one.
They developed a quantum slipstream drive to try and get home. It didn't fully work and the ship crashed. And Harry Kim blames himself because he was in the Delta Flyer with Chakotay at the front, feeding them course corrections so that they could make it safely through the slipstream. He messed up and the entire crew perished. And now he and Chakotay have come back 15 years later to find the Voyager and to change history by getting the Doctor and his mobile emitter, and
that's right,
getting Seven of Nine's body, which has the ability to, well, it has the information they need to send a message through time back to Seven of Nine at the moment of the accident to correct the coordinates that he sent. And so the entire episode is flashing back and forth between this future where they are grimly making their last ditch attempt as fugitives on the run who have stolen time message sending technology and the Delta Flyer in order to save their family by changing history, and flashing back to the moments leading up to this crash. And it's they do some beautiful interplay between these two threads. There's a moment where Chakotay sits down on the ice-filled bridge of Voyager and replays the last captain's log that's in the console. And it's Janeway saying, "I want to recommend all of my crew for citations for valor," or whatever.
Except then, Harry Kim. Except Harry Kim. He's not getting a citation or a promotion. Go play a clarinet.
And then we flash back and we watch Janeway actually record that log after we've heard it on the bridge. So that delightful kind of time travel shenanigans is going on here. There's some weird, like, the doctor cuts open, we don't see it off screen, the doctor slices up Seven of Nine's body, and then for several long scenes he's holding a chunk of her skull in his hand as he's like scanning it for the information they need, and it's really kind of grisly.
Yeah.
And there is one cut that is almost a match cut between the chunk of her skull and we cut to Seven of Nine in the past speaking, and it is so like, oh, disturbing. Great episode. We do ultimately, at the risk of spoiling the episode, their plan doesn't go right the first time, and so we get to see the crash.
Yeah.
And in the 1990s budget restrictions that they had, they did a marvelous job of the ship kind of, you know, brushing against the top of an icy mountain before like going down and hitting in a way that feels real hard, that ice, and it's kicking up snow everywhere and it's skidding along the surface. And then we cut away. We don't see the aftermath. We don't see people thrown out of their chairs or anything like that. All we then see is the icy remains on the bridge 15 years later. But it's
because this is all CGI.
It's Voyager, all CGI on a TV budget, but boy, does it look good. It holds up, even though they, like, this is one of the episodes I would love to see an HD remake of someday. But even in the 4x3 standard definition quality that we're stuck with for Voyager, it still looks great.
Yeah, I do remember that episode. I do like, you know, those what if stories of Star Trek where they can delve into being a little bit darker and the horrors of what is potential. And then there's the reset at the end to go back. Whew, well, that's what it could have been, but that's not what our world is now. We'll wait for Discovery where it's all at. But yeah, it's that, and you know, trying to make Harry Kim a bit more interesting. I think he had facial hair in this episode as well.
Yeah, this is one of the meteor episodes for Garrett Wang to play with. He gets to play old, kind of damaged Harry Kim, who blames himself and has been through a lot of therapy that didn't work.
Clearly.
It's a good one. It's standalone. If you're listening to this, listener, and you're like, oh, I watched some Voyager, or I've never watched some Voyager, you could watch this one all by itself.
Yeah, just get straight into
it. No connections to canon, and it's a good one.
And I love the threat of it. It's like crashing a starship onto a planet, no matter what planet it is going to cause some damage. It's not just as easy as putting on shields and, you know, being on a 45 jaunty angle and getting some dirt on you. That's the big thing that focuses in the Discovery episode, isn't it? They go, oh, I've got to get out all this sand. Oh, we've got sand. So much sand is in the ship.
So much sand, yeah.
Yeah.
In Voyager, they make a point of saying decks 10 through 14 are now deck 10. They were compacted on landing.
So yes, from what I remember, I love it when they go dark in these type of stories so that they can really explore how these characters cope with unimaginable horror in these situations. Because spaces, yes, it's liberating and it's freedom and it's exploration and it's positive and hope, but also it's dangerous, it's deadly, it's horrifying, and can cause some real horrific, talk about Dave Cronenberg, that's some body horror right there.
Should we talk about the big one?
Let's do it. Let's do it. Star Trek Generations. This is an epic crash. And this is very much a case of, this is the first Next Generation movie with all our stuff. Let's do a big crash. And it's a balance of CGI and so practical.
It's a real model.
That's a big thing they pushed in the making of. I remember they released back in the day, like teaser VHSs, where you'd get a making of Star Trek Generations VHS that would come with a newspaper, or you get it from the news agency, and you could watch, okay, there's this big sequence, and they'd show this teaser of,
we made this model for us. We hand painted every tree.
Every tree and every color scheme of shading on the on the saucered part of the Enterprise. And it was huge. It's not like a mini model. It's like a massive saucer that they flew into this designed wilderness.
The overriding impression that this one leaves me with is that it's bigger than you expect. Like so many of the other crashes, you're like, oh, this might be big. And then the show kind of just rises to your expectations. This one rises to your expectations and then keeps going. How long it lasts.
Yes.
Like, once they're on the ground, it just becomes this rolling earthquake. And we cut from scene to scene, from room to room, as people are like holding each other and the whole thing is shaking. And that feeling of, I am in an earthquake. And at some point, this is going to stop. And that's going to be bad too. That dread of the ending of it, when you're in the middle of it, is something that none of these other ones ever quite achieve.
No, it definitely splits it into two. There's the and both are equally deadly and horrifying, is not only the crash into the planet, but then when you're in the planet, the momentum that's built up and how you stop. So it's two parts of, oh my God, we're going to crash into this planet. And then it's the case of, we're on the planet now and we have got this carnage going along. And there's, like you said, they extend it out. They go, this happens and this happens and this happens, while they're just coming to a halt. And it goes on for so long. It's a perfect capture of what a crash landing of a Federation ship. Only half. It's only even half of the ship.
It's only half. Yeah. The Star Drive section goes up in a big ball of light before this.
Definitely.
Well, it's one of my favorite Deanna Troi beats, when she's at the con, and a lot has been snickeringly made in cynical fan circles about, you know, the one time they put Deanna at the con, she crashes the ship. But I just love that moment once they're on the ground and she's still at her station. And I think it's Data, but someone is like hugging her and she's crying at her station while she's still trying to do her best to save this ship. It is so touching.
Yeah.
In this moment of high spectacle, the thing that sticks with me is an emotional beat amongst it all.
And it's what they do in the movies. There's gag that goes around in the community going, oh, it's a Star Trek movie, better blow up the Enterprise again. but this was a big statement.
There have
statement.
Been a few.
Yes. There's been a statement of it. The Enterprise is like the Kenny of South Park.
It is. It's the character that you can rebuild after you kill them off. And so it's the cheapest way to give the audience that sense of loss.
Exactly. But it is that case of, it was the big moment of going, we're moving to the movies right now. And so what you've known of Star Trek Next Generation has changed. And so a big step is, you've known this ship, this bridge, for 7 years, and we are destroying it. There's that final moment with Riker and Picard on the ship to say goodbye, on the deck to say goodbye to it.
Yeah.
And then we come, but, and then in many ways, I mean, for me, I don't know if you feel the same way, the Enterprise is after that in First Contact and Nemesis and Insurrection were never as iconic. They were more Batmobile, like slicker and sexier, but there's something.
I like the E. I think the E is as good as they could have possibly made it. It is a worthy successor, but it's never quite the same. I agree.
Yeah. But it is that monumental moment of loss. You do lose something. You do lose people, and, you know, feel the importance of a crash. Because if if it just nobody is lost and all you need to do is clean off sand, it takes away any type of drama, any importance, any stake. So yeah.
Well, there you go. Those are our highlights of Crash's past. There have been others. Like you said, we had Into Darkness, and Star Trek Beyond made a big, you know, show of dismantling the Enterprise and having a saucer crash of its own. But we'll leave that as an exercise for the listener to go and revisit that one.
And I always bring up Star Trek IV, so the, you know, the the Klingon ship crashing into San Francisco Bay.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. Well, it's good to be back, Rob. I look forward to our next outing on Discovery. I have high hopes for this season. Like, in a way that Discovery has my expectations low, and this is so far quite good for Discovery. So I think I'm going to enjoy this season.
Yeah. Look, I'm not as invested in this show or this crew as
understandable as
you. There are moments that I'm liking. I'm liking Cronenberg. I'm always loved Doug Jones. There's stuff in there that I will be intrigued, but I'm very interested to talk to you about it because we've never done, like, everything we've reviewed so far, I've loved.
I know. Just in the same way that this is the first Discovery that used that stinger, that animated opening at the start. I had to check myself and realize of 50 episodes of the show that we did, all of them came after the last episode of Discovery. So this is our first time actually talking about Discovery here.
Yeah. We started halfway through the first
Strange
season
New Worlds,
of
yeah.
Strange New Worlds. So it's and I've loved Strange New Worlds. You got me onto Lower Decks, and I'm friggin' loving Lower Decks. And Prodigy as well was the surprise one that I'm particularly loving. I know there's a lot of anger out there with where Star Trek's going, but I've found nothing but joy and positivity of it that connects to the ethos of what we love about Star Trek at the height of it, the 60s and the height of the 90s, which a lot of people see as, you know, gospel, and you can't obtain that again. But it's interesting to come to a Star Trek that I am not a fan of, but to talk about it week to week, I'm very interested to see where it goes and what conversations I can have with you. And hopefully the people listening enjoy it as much as I am doing it here with you.
Well, until next week, Rob.
See you around the galaxy.